where strategy gaming meets good vibes. No stress, just critical moves.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Critical Moves podcast. My name is Jochen Heiden, but you can call me Shane. I'm joined here by Al.
Hello, strategy gamers.
Sir Nuno.
Hello, guys.
And Timothy.
Good day, everyone.
Today's episode is entitled The Strategy Games That Made Us. So what we're going to be doing here is we're going to be talking about three influential strategy games that we have played in our strategy gaming careers. The first one we're going to talk about is the first strategy game that we've played. The second thing we're going to discuss is the hook game, or the game that got us really hooked into strategy gaming. And then lastly, we're going to discuss our most recent strategy game that we've been playing. So we're going to go ahead and start off with Al. I'd like him to go ahead and tell us about the first strategy game that he's ever played.
So this will be one that everybody has played, I would imagine. Red Alert, part of the Command & Conquer series, released in 1996. Just an absolute eye-opener for me in terms of what you could do in games. I just found it to be just the setting, the alternate history, the World War II was just a fantastic experience.
Yeah, definitely played it. I think most of us have.
My favorite part about the Red Alert game were the cutscenes, the videos in between the missions. Those were the best.
Yeah, the FMV cutscenes were amazing back then. It's a shame that those have went out of style by now, right?
I'm not a huge fan, personally. I don't think they're that great.
Oh, man. Come on.
It's so cheesy. I mean, you know, like, I get it. I get what it's going for, but it's just not something for me, personally. I find them so cheesy and over the top.
Yeah, but I think it went perfectly well with the tone of the game, because, like, Red Alert never took itself too seriously. Like, it was just kind of a goofy setting, and then Red Alert 2 actually even took that goofiness further with their super weapons and, like, the sci-fi setting. Half sci-fi setting, right? Because it's based on the Cold War. And the FMV scenes had a lot of famous people in them back then. Like, they have...
Tim Curry.
Like, exactly. Tim mm-hmm. Curry was like...
Oh, it's right. Tim Curry was in there. Mm-hmm.
So, if we're talking about strategy, I found that game really lacking in strategy. I mean, it was fine when I was a kid. I enjoyed it. And it was funky with, like, attack dogs eating people and so on, but when you think about, like, the actual strategy, it's an extremely simplified game, right? Like, there wasn't that much strategy to it. It was like a lot of rock, paper, scissors, simple resources management.
It was, but I think that you have to consider where this was in the pantheon of strategy games. It was one of the first. You know, you had Herzog's Vi, you had Dune 2. And then you had Command & Conquer, really, which was 95, Red Alert was 96. This was at a time when strategy games weren't well-known, weren't well-received, and this made... Westwood Studios played an absolute blinder, and this, for me, was really the thing which put RTS and strategy games on the map. And I think because of the funky FMV, because it was a serious subject, but it was wrapped in this less than serious presentation, I think that made it really, really accessible. Of course, if you compare it to today's titles, or if you compare it to other kinds of strategy games, your grand strategies, your 4Xs, it's not got the same strategic requirements. But as a standalone, and as many people's first introduction to the RTS genre, I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and I think it actually did something that some of the RTS games of today are afraid of making, which is it played a lot with the unit you have, so you don't have like set or basic units, unit presets, right? So you didn't have like your infantry, your anti-air, your tanks and all that. And while we did have that and have those units, it also had a lot of experimental ones. So I remember like you had flying guys that had machine guns, you had Tesla coils, you had hero units, which were actually like, I remember that Yuri was a hero unit back then. So it was a very powerful unit. And I don't think there's another game back then that actually did that. And you have like cruise missiles units, you have sea warfare, which also wasn't a staple back then. And like those late game units were really cool. Like, for example, the tanks with the two guns and all that. It brings a lot of...
The mammoth tank.
Yeah, the mammoth tank, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think if you compare it to a game like Settlers, which came out around the same time, Settlers was much more complex and a lot deeper for around the same period. And maybe not as well known, especially back then, but that's my thing. And then I would add to that afterwards, the Red Alert 2, Command & Conquer, and so on, the series kept that simplicity. And I'm sure a lot of people appreciate that, and that's fine, but this is not something for me, and it stayed in that simple. You say, like, yeah, in 95 or whichever year it came out, it was still the early days, but they kept at it. They never improved the complexity of the formula at all.
Well, I suppose, do you need to improve on it? If you look at the Civilization series, we're going to have Civilization 7 in February 2025. It won't be a significant improvement on Civ 6, which wasn't a significant jump from Civ 5. If you have a formula that works, play it until it works. But of course, this formula didn't continue to work. The Red Alert 1 was fantastic. Red Alert 2 was, some people think it was even better. I thought things got a little bit too outlandish for me. As much as Red Alert 1 had, Tanya, the hero, it had different units. It was still, I don't want to use the word realistic, but it was kind of acceptable.
It was grounded, right?
Somewhat grounded. Mm-hmm. Where if you look at Red Alert 2, where there's a tank that can, you know, with a cannon that can fire infantry across rivers and things, I think they took the slapstick too far. And I think that they, When you look at the other games in the Tiberium series, they probably weren't as camp as what Red Alert was.
Well, tell you what, let's move on because we got a lot of other games to cover here, guys. I know Red Alert is definitely near and dear to most people's hearts, except for Timothy. But I'd like to hear about Nuno. Why don't you tell us about your first strategy game?
I think I'm probably the most vanilla guy out here because my actually first RTS game was Age of Empires 2, and I think that it goes without saying that Age of Empires is still a staple to this day and age because it's actually like I personally believe that it set the foundations for what RTS was going to be like for the next decade. I think Age of Empires came out in like 96, 97, I think, or 98 maybe. And it followed up on the original, of course, but Age of Empires 2 just basically took whatever experimental mechanics games at the time were doing and it executed them so well that it formed the foundation for what RTS was going to be. And I was lucky enough to have that experience first, and I was lucky on one hand and then kind of not so lucky on the other one, because going back to other titles made it very difficult, because I played Age of Empires 2 first and then I went back to play the original, and I remember feeling a bit charred by how not polished it was. But I gotta say, like, Age of Empires 2 for me to this, it's a game that I still play to this day because it's so well tuned, and it has a lot of small mechanics that I didn't knew existed like for like 20 years. So the fact that archers do extra damage because they're firing from like an uphill position, I never knew that as a kid, because like, remember that when Age of Empires came out, I was like 8 years old, so I didn't even knew how to speak English back then. So it was all guessing. And like units have penetration values and all that. It's really well made. And then the economy aspect of it also, it's not complex enough to the point where it's really hard to get into it, but it's also complex enough that you need to play around with it. And I'm not talking about like metagaming, the kind of min-maxing everything. I'm just talking about like a general feel of it. And then something else that really drives me to Age of Empires is this medieval aspect of it, because I really love the medieval times. And I think that until Total War Medieval 2, until I played Total War Medieval 2, I think that Age of Empires for me was like the realistic medieval game to go. And as someone who always loved that era since I was a small kid, I think it was my go-to game for years. Like, I remember, like, until 2006, it's just when Company of Heroes came out, I was still playing Age of Empires, like, pretty much every single game. For me...
You say you still play it today. Well, you're not alone. It's still one of the, if not the most played RTS game out there. And it's not just set the stage for the next 10 years. It's set the stage for up until today almost. Games that come out today still take a lot from that game. So absolutely amazing game. One of my most played games ever, I would say. And so much fun. So nice. And competitive too. It's crazy. There's still today, like, people playing it competitively for very large amounts. And you mentioned, like, some small details you didn't know about. I think there's good and bad about that. But there's also a YouTuber, quite active, quite popular as well, Spirit of the Law. He still puts out YouTube videos explaining some hidden mechanics in the game. I think that's, like, that's incredible.
Yeah, and I think, like, so another thing that actually helped me to... I think it not helped me to love the game, but something that really pushed it forward to me was also the Conqueror's expansion, because the Conqueror's expansion was also fantastic. And I remember that back then, like, I'm someone who's from Portugal. Portugal is very rarely seen in games, and I didn't have Portugal back then, but I had Spain as a country or as a playable faction back then, and I loved, like, I just played, like, Spain all day. Like, I just played with bots because I didn't have internet back then. So I just, like, played with bots. Until today, I never played Age of Empires online ever. I'm just, like, a solo gamer. So for me, Age of Empires has always been, like, a single-player experience. I played all the campaigns, and I think I played all skirmish maps against probably all factions.
Tim, what about you? What's your first game?
So one of the biggest strategy games that I played starting out was Anno 1602. And that game was quite something for me. And what I appreciate till this day, really, is that it's not such a straightforward, easy, oh, you do this and then you do that. Especially when you're discovering the game, you have to kind of figure it out and puzzle it together, and you kind of struggle against the environment a bit. And there's like bad things coming at you that you have to overcome and so on. And I think that's really great if you have, if you're not just free to do whatever you want, where you want, but you have, like, some force of nature counterbalancing that, and you have to overcome that. And that's a lot of fun for me, the pressure that you get, the thinking that you have to have, and the mindset it gives you as well. And playing a game that's not just free build, it's a challenge, it's something you need to overcome, basically. Yeah, I really enjoyed that a lot. I don't know if you guys played it or played one of the newer versions.
I've played Anno 1800, which is relatively new. I never played the one that you're mentioning, though.
It's really old, like it's from the 90s, and it's really fun. It was funny. It's the same principle as Anno 1800, but very simplified, obviously, because of, you know, constraints.
Well, I played 1503, I think, like, mm-hmm. It was the next game on the series, all the way back then also. And I remember picking it up, like, from the brick and mortar store and not knowing what it was. I just picked up because the box cover looked cool. Like, it had, like, a guy and some ships on it. So I thought it might be an interesting game. But I struggled a lot with it because mainly I didn't speak English back then. So also very hard to play an economics-based game with it. But yeah, I found it. So since I was so... I had a lot of habits from Age of Empires 2. Like, going to a game that's mainly focused on the economic aspect of it instead of the military one, it was a really hard transition for me. But I loved it, and I still play. So I remember playing the game for years to come, and I also really enjoyed, like, Anno 1800. I mean, it's a fantastic title, and it's a great return to form after... 27, I think. I don't remember, like, the last title prior to 1800. I mean, it was...
Yeah, but they also made one in space and so on. I didn't try that one, but 1800 is very polished, very well done. The feel of the game and then the difficulty of it scales really, really well, and you get a really city builder out of it and everything. So, 1800 is, like, very good, yeah.
I'm curious to know, just so why did you enjoy, like, what kind of aspect did you like?
Yeah, it was difficult, and I would play it with my friend at the time. We would go to each other's house and play together, just the two of us, just like trying to figure out the economics part. And you can play competitive 1v1 with military, and I think that's fun too, and there's something like I did that a lot too, but then it's something different, and I miss that in a lot of other games. A lot of strategy games, they're all about like 1v1, very like highly competitive, trying to outsmart each other with like moving units or which unit to make and so on. And I enjoy that, and that's really fun. But this is something different, and I really appreciate that for what it is. And at the time, as a kid, I loved it as well. And I wished more games were like that, to be honest.
So is Anno 117 on your wish list then?
It is. I'll see what happens from it. But yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of people enjoy that as well. And it's a bit of a hidden gem in the Anno series. And it's been a bit discovered with 1800. And I think there's more, even more that it can accomplish and do. And get co-op as well. Anno 1800 is really good with co-op. And not enough strategy games are co-op, I think. And that could be really fun.
This new one's Pax Romana. I guess it's based in ancient Rome, which I think is something which has been done to death.
Oh, I was going to say the opposite. Yeah, I think Rome has been severely lacking lately.
Well, we played Caesar. Caesar was fun, no?
Maybe recently, but over time, it's been milked. But anyway, moving on.
Oh, okay, moving on. I think it's my turn then. All right, so I'm gonna take you guys back to the past here. So the first strategy game I ever played was called The Civil War, and it was a 1995 title made by a British company of all things called Dagger Interactive, and it was published by a company called Empire. Now, I bought this game on CD-ROM with my Packard Bell Legend 204 CD computer. It was the first real modern computer that I had, and I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry for this game, and it said the game received mixed to negative reviews from Computer Game Review. In 1996, it said it was the 10th worst computer game ever released. And you know what? I don't know what game they were playing, because I absolutely loved this game. I was, 1995, I was 10, 11 years old, and I loved it. The graphics seemed good to me. Obviously, I was looking through it through a different lens, but it was great because it had... It's like a turn-based game, but you resolve the battles in real time. So you had a strategic map where you would build units and do your economy, move your naval forces, move your units around the map to whatever objectives. And then whenever they came into contact with enemy forces, you would fight the battle in real time. And maybe other games had been doing that, but it's one of the very first that I can think of that you had both a turn-based strategy, strategic portion, and a real-time strategy where you fight the tactical battles. And, you know, Empire, Total War, all the Total War series are like that, but they came way later than this.
Do you think that this was an inspiration for the first Total War game? Because that was released in 2000. Shogun Total War was released in 2000.
Potentially so, but to me, the game is very obscure, and I don't think a lot of people know about it.
Because it's the Civil War. There's never been a more boring war in history.
What are you talking about? As a kid, I was so into Civil War history, and when I found a game that helped me visualize the history that I'd been reading in books, it just really put me over the top. So my vote for my first strategy game, and the one that definitely, the earliest one that I can recall, was definitely The Civil War, 1995.
When you compare it to Total War games, how similar is it? You mentioned about the turn-based and the real-time.
Not even close. It's very archaic. I mean, you can go on YouTube and type Civil War 1995 and you can watch some videos. It's Stone Age compared to Total War, but the concepts were the same.
So Shane, is it one of those cases of I was a kid and any game would have been, I would have been fine with it. I would have had a patience with any game, and this is the game that fell into my lap?
Probably, but it fit the genre of history that I liked, and it just had, it clicked all the boxes for something that entertained me, and I played it for several years. But when we get around to this next game, eventually you'll see a common theme with me. But I know what I want to keep this moving on because we got a lot more stuff to talk about. So I'm going to circle back around to Al, and I'm going to ask you now, what was a strategy game that really got you hooked in strategy gaming?
You're going to see a theme for these next ones, and a little bit of fanboyism here, because the game that really, really made me think that strategy games, or RTS in particular, was just the best thing ever was Total Annihilation from 1997. Developed by Cave Dog, really developed by Chris Taylor, who went on to make Supreme Commander. It just took what I enjoyed about Red Alert and just dialed it up to 1,000. Incredible maps. The factions were fairly samey. There was no asymmetry in them, but just the story. I'm a huge sci-fi nut. The story was a brilliant setting. The arm versus the core, and I just spent hours making maps. There was a built-in map editor, which you don't really get anymore in games. I spent hours making maps to then fight over. It had things like patrol mechanics, which you still don't get in a lot of RTS games. You could just set units to patrol particular areas. Just a huge time sink for me. I do get quite obsessive, and I would say I would have racked up hours into the thousands playing TA from 1997 onwards.
And one of the things like Total Annihilation had back then was the scale, right? You didn't have any other title that had that kind of scale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was just huge. You know, it was huge, only made bigger by Subcom, which was...
Did you play online, Al?
No, I am not competitive when it comes to gaming. I am an awful combination of extremely competitive and really, really bad. So I would lose all the time. I would rage quit all the time. So it was just, I know my limits. I've tried Beyond All Reason recently. So there's, which of course is Total Annihilation. It is, you know, the units, the K-bots, the solar extractors, it is TA.
What did you think?
I need to give it some more time. I played one of the scenarios, and it took me back. It took me back to 97, which isn't a bad thing when you're at my age, you know. It was like reliving my youth.
Yeah.
You know,
And it doesn't look like 97 either.
No, it doesn't. It's certainly not as it's certainly not groundbreaking graphically, you know. But I think that's probably because I know that there's boasts of having dozens of players online at the same time, 10,000 units at the same time. You don't need something which is super powerful for things to be fun.
Shane, can you guess my next game?
Well, hold on. We'll get to that. But let's take it back to Nuno first. Because he's next one on the list. Let's hear it. What's the hook game for you?
So my hook game for me, I think I have two. So this might be a contentious one. The first one, and might be a bit boring, is actually Stronghold. So for those that don't know, Stronghold is a game it's a game also from, I think, 2000 or 2001. And it was a medieval castle builder, basically, or an RTS medieval castle builder. And it's actually for the same reason that I mentioned before. It's just I love the medieval times, and then I remember playing Age of Empires 2, and in Age of Empires 2, despite being set in the medieval times, you couldn't actually do medieval stuff. So you didn't have production chains, you didn't have castles, you weren't able to garrison your wall. So while it was medieval, it didn't feel like. And Stronghold made it feel very medieval. It took things up to the extreme, and it actually zoomed in a lot on that aspect, and I loved it. But I think that the other game is actually Company of Heroes. I think that the game that really set me off after Age of Empires was Company of Heroes. And this might not surprise a lot of people, because Company of Heroes is a groundbreaking game also from way back when, released in 2006. I think Company of Heroes was actually the game that also picked a lot on what other titles were doing way back when, like I'm trying to remember the name, like Panzer Corps, I think, was an RTS, World War II Frontline Command, and it took all the, it, and it was also it also released during the World War II craze after the after Rescuing Private Ryan and all Private Ryan and all those and all the movies that came after, and it was the first game that managed to introduce cover to RTS titles in a way that's both intuitive, fun, and it makes sense, because World War II was a lot like that. So if you try to use these mechanics on a medieval title or a World War I game, it wouldn't make a lot of sense. But in World War II was the perfect setting for Company of Heroes to kick off. And they actually did like the four Fs of fix or find, fix or fire, flank, and finish. They did it. They did that excellent. And they the campaign was also amazing. The graphics were incredible back then, and like the two DLCs they had were also pretty cool and added a lot to the game. So for me, I think like this was another stepping stone to eventually go into wargaming, which is something I do a lot right now. So yeah, Company of Heroes was another title for me.
Can I say that Strongholds I think was a fabulous game that was extremely innovative, very different, and I think captured one of the most important things of the medieval warfare is the castle sieging aspect that is missing so much from other medieval games. Like I was praising Age of Empires 2 so much, but the sieging mechanic is so dumbed down and simplified and doesn't have many of the crucial elements like boiling oil and so on that Stronghold was able to capture perfectly, I think.
Yeah, but that's because Stronghold also built a lot on top of what other games have done before. Not so much
because the economy works completely differently than any of the other RTSs. Like the popularity thing, that means that you have more citizens or less citizens, but then the more you have, then they require more food, and if they don't have food, they're unhappy. And then like the workers going to their job to their, you know.
You had to set production chains, you had to protect those production chains, and it was for the first time you could actually starve a castle, which is a realistic part of medieval warfare, is that you could starve a castle to defeat.
And so it was an amazing castle siege game, and at the same time it had this like really innovative new way of doing the economy aspect of that at the same time, which I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, and something else, like the modular building of walls was actually unseen back when, and it was really cool because you could build to your heart's content.
Is it similar to Cataclysmo? You mentioned about modular castle building.
Yeah, Cataclysmo is heavily inspired by Stronghold, yeah.
All right, here's what we got. Great conversation, but I want to make sure we don't forget about Tim here. So Tim, what do you got? What's your hook game?
Well, you've heard it before, and it actually started some years after Total Annihilation, with people wanting to recreate Total Annihilation in a new engine to capture like a really good 3D mechanic that in the 90s was really difficult to do. And they started with this Spring engine, on which over decades of time they built what is today known as Beyond All Reason. And I've been playing that on and off for almost 20 years now, and it is the absolute peak of RTS gaming you can have to this day, and nothing comes close to it. And it's absolutely it just blows out all the competition out of the water. I'm not even exaggerating. It is nothing to do with me being part of it. It's just the mechanics, the UI. I have something to say, you know, all of these other games, they're built by studios who have this timeline of like, okay, we're going to build this game in a year, 2 years or something like that. We have this budget and we're creating this and we're releasing this and hope that's the game. With this, it's a completely different process altogether. So first and foremost, it's all volunteers doing it. It's a free open source game, and anyone can just come and add to the game, say, oh, I've been playing this game, but you know, it would be really nice if I could do this in the game, or that would be there. Yeah, sure, go ahead, add it, do that. And if other people like it, if the team likes it and everything, it gets incorporated really quickly, much faster, much more seamlessly than any mod would from any games that we have. So it's like mods are added, but they're like part of the game, basically.
It's not very original, though, is it?
What isn't?
Beyond Our Reason. It is just Total Annihilation with a new suit.
So let me tell you some things that are original. And this is, for example, something that has existed, I think, for like 15 years now. If you right-click, you have an army, yeah, and you move the army, and you right-click it to somewhere, instead of all moving to one point, you can click and drag a custom line, completely custom line. So you want them in a triangle, you want them in a circle, you want them in a zigzag line, whichever. Your units seamlessly move to that. And still, I discover new strategy games, new RTS games that come out, and you still can't do that. And this has been out for 15 years. I was like, come on, man. Like, you're lagging so far behind with all of these RTS games. Like, how can you not do these like really simple things that have been figured out so long ago? And that's just like one tiny, tiny aspect of Bard that makes it so good. But there's just tons and tons of those.
Okay, I'm going to have to play some more.
No, honestly, there's like tons of like really innovative elements to it, and you can say that the gameplay itself is not that new, but when it comes to competitive gaming, and I think that's where the game shines. Although there's also really good PvE modes to it, or two modes even to it, is that it's such a complex game. I can talk for hours about this, but it's such a complex game that today there's still tournaments going out where new strategies, new ways of playing are being figured out, because it has a few elements that other RTSs don't have. One is, for example, you can shoot and move at the same time. I think there's very few RTSs that have that, but something that does is that you can infinitely micro your units, since there's always something for them to do. And there's no rock, paper, scissors system, which I think is such a relief. I think rock, paper, scissors is so overdone in strategy games. And what that does is that the units are good against other units based off of, for example, the weapon reload time, the area of effect, the unit's health, and all the complex interactions between all of those different things. For example, if something has like a very big area of effect, it's good against cheap units where you send a lot of them, but then if there's a different situation where the cheap unit gets close up to your units, the area of effect suddenly kills your own unit. So it's not just a simple interaction of this unit is good against that unit. It's like a really complex dynamic, and I think that's absolutely genius.
Okay, all right, my turn. So we're going to talk about my hook game, and surprise, surprise, I mentioned there's going to be a common theme here. It is Civil War Generals 2 from 1997, published by Sierra Online. And if you were any kind of computer gamer from the 90s, you'll recognize the name Sierra Online.
Absolutely.
They have an incredible catalog of games. I played tons of them. I mean, I had to pick one game, but there was probably 20 games that Sierra published back in the 90s that I played. But I want to focus on this one because it was the one that really got me hooked. The first Civil War game was great, but this one really got me into turn-based strategy games that have, like, they play with the hex system, right? This was the first game that I'd ever played where there was hexes and you had to move your units around and you had to think about different directions of attack and flanking and, you know, victory point positions, terrain on the map. And they also had a lot of cool little cutscenes, not unlike Red Alert, but they were more historical in nature where they'd be like Civil War reenactors, having battles in between your battles. You can watch a little video or you could skip it. But, you know, between it being a Sierra game, which is already awesome, and another Civil War game, which I just have a thing in special place in my heart for that. I don't know why. Civil War Generals 2 from 1997 was definitely the game that got me really hooked into strategy gaming and turn-based strategy gaming in that situation.
But I have to ask you, Shane, do you have any other modern Civil War games that you like? Because I'm really curious to learn about that.
Boy, you know what? I know there's a bunch out there, but I just have kind of moved on. So, like, I love Civil War stuff. I still like reading about the history, and I'm still a fan of, well, I don't want to say fan of war, but I'm really involved. I would say, like, the what's that one game that came out? Who makes it? It's there's a Civil War game that I was playing a couple years ago that was really good.
The Ultimate General?
Ultimate General, yes. Oh, absolutely. I really enjoyed those games. They're kind of dated now. I tried to go back and play one recently, and I just wasn't feeling it. I kind of got burned out on it. But when they were new, I played the Gettysburg one, and I played the whole Civil War one. In fact, about 6 months ago, I just finished a Confederate campaign. So that game is great, too. I enjoyed it. But it doesn't have the same kind of nostalgia for me that Civil War Generals 2 did, because 1997, I was 13 years old. So those are still really formative years for me and my brain about computer games and computer technology. So when that game came out, it was prime for me to really get into that kind of stuff. So that's my hook game.
But so there was Ultimate General Civil War, and then there was Ultimate General American Revolution when we allowed you to have your country.
Oh, yeah. The Revolution one is still very new, and I haven't even tried that one yet. But the Civil War one I definitely played.
Yeah, the Civil War one is actually great. It's a really cool game. Like both Gettysburg and Civil War are amazing. I played both.
They're very good. But
so Shane, I do have to say that as someone from, you know, far away Europe who doesn't know that much about the American Civil War and hasn't played much of those games, in the future I'd be really curious to hear your thoughts about the whole strategic aspect of that and those games included. Perhaps not today, but yeah, I'd be very curious about that.
Oh, yeah. Some other time, let's have a long conversation about it, because there's so much to discuss about the American Civil War, from the logistics, the strategic level, the tactical battles, the generals, the personalities. We had it all. No one does Civil War like the United States, man. We really turn it up to the next level when we do our Civil Wars. You guys don't even know.
Here in Europe at that time, you had Napoleonic wars, which was like same-ish timeline, but played out, I believe, quite differently. And I'm really curious about like the similarities, the differences, and like the things you could link between the two. You know,
I would love to have that conversation, and I think that's probably a great episode in the future. But I definitely want to move on, because we do need to finish with our current games, and I want to circle back around for the last time to Al. And I'd like you to talk to us about the current Strike game that you're playing.
So I mentioned a bit of fanboyism. Chris Taylor, I think, was with Total Annihilation and then with Supreme Commander, which for me is the pinnacle. Sorry, Tim. Supreme Commander is the pinnacle of RTS games. he called this the spiritual successor to Supreme Commander, and it is Sanctuary Shattered Sun. It's in development at the moment, but I work with the development team. I help them with their community management, and as a consequence, I have full access to the pre-alpha game. And it is just, this is the team, Enhearten Media, they're called, and there's only maybe a dozen people working on this. It's been in development for about 3 years, 4 years now. It is Supreme Commander in a new suit, like TA is now Bar, but they have taken it to the next level. Some of the mechanics in there, there's a situation where you can, it's set on a Dyson sphere, which has been built around the sun, and there's super weapons you can use to shatter the map. You know, you can blow huge holes in the map, which everything just falls into the sun beneath. It's just absolutely fantastic. You can use different mechanics to freeze the oceans. If you freeze the ocean, then any amphibious units moving across the ocean get trapped under the ice. Ships can no longer move, and tanks can roll right across. So these mechanics to just change the entire dynamic. You know, you're separated by a huge lake from your opponent. You freeze the map and you just roll your tank straight across. It's just incredible. When you think of the team that have made it, they're all veterans of Forge Alliance Forever. They worked on FAF a lot, as in creating maps, creating units. One of the guys created the Nomad faction for FAF. But the I could, again, talk about it for forever. We'll do that in another episode. I'll try and get the guys on to talk to us. But Sanctuary Shattered Sun is definitely one to watch out for.
So, what do I got for you? So currently I've been playing, a lot this week, but I played Burden of Command. And for those that don't know, Burden of Command is a World War II war game, maybe, like a turn-based strategy title where the focus is on you leading your unit into battle. So it's basically you put like brothers in arms, Panzer generals, and maybe some company of heroes like into a big melting pot, and what you got is Burden of Command. Also a couple of history books and documentaries in there. You got Burden of Command. It's a really cool, really cool idea. It has a demo on Steam available right now. And the game is mostly focused on one thing, is that you are an officer leading your men into battle. So you have the responsibility of keeping your guys alive. You have the responsibility of teaching them, of making sure they're well. And the idea of the game is that you start to build an emotional connection with them, which is something you don't see a lot in strategy games, right? Because mostly you're looking at pixels or lines of code on a screen, and Burden of Command wants to bring like the humanity aspect of warfare into war games, which is something that has never been done before. And I really liked the game. It's a bit too complex for the scale it has, because it has a squad or a platoon scale, and things can get a bit messy with its turn structure, and I think the game might struggle with catching a new audience with it. But I think if you have the patience and you like World War II and you like reading about it, Burden of Command might be a very interesting game, because it does a lot. It has a massive love for history and for the conflict and for the people that fought in it, and it's something that you don't see a lot. The game has been in development for like nearly 10 years, I think. And the guys that they're a very small team. They have a guy called Luke leading it. I've actually interviewed him a couple of years ago. And the guy really loves history. And he has a lot of like historical advisors. He went to the point of colorizing World War II pictures, like restoring videos and all that. And the game, it has a massive historical archive. It's a really interesting title that I would actually advise everyone to just go and play, see for yourself if you like it or not. But if even if it doesn't do that well as a game, I think it's going to be do great to teach history to people. And that's something that I've been missing a lot from games lately.
Are there any benefits? Are there any benefits in keeping your squads alive? Or you mentioned this emotional connection.
So we have a demo right now, and the demo is pretty limited. But like, I know your squads level up. They gather like they gain veterancy, they gain new skills. So yeah, there's a lot of incentive to keep them alive. And I'm really hoping that the final version of the game in the campaign, like the choices you have, because you're constantly, like your gameplay is constantly being interrupted by choices. So the game is constantly throwing new challenges at you. And there's one thing really interesting is that you don't ever have, or at least you don't seem to ever have like a correct option. Like you're always choosing the best of the better option of the worst, of the worst options you have. So you just need to pick the one that looks good to you at the moment. And I think that for someone, I think most of us here have led teams before, I think that's, you can relate a lot to that. So despite not being a military guy, I've been leading teams on a corporate environment for nearly 10 years. And like your day to day is basically that. You're just making the best of what you have. Here, the game is actually, it's trying to materialize that on gaming, on a video game. And I think that's, I think you need to, you need to celebrate that. It's a very rare achievement to do. Like very few games attempt to do that. So most games just focus on the depthness, how deep the mechanics are, how good the graphics are. And like Burden of Command just says, okay, we have cool graphics and the game looks decent. It has some kind of paint-like art style to it, but it takes that humanity aspect and it throws you into the game. So you have to, you really need to take care of your squad, and that's something that for the first time, and I've been playing like war games for 10 years maybe now, I've seen that. It's the first time I've actually seen someone build a game around that, and it's really cool. I really like it. If you guys haven't tried it, you really should try it.
Awesome. So, hey, let's get on to Timothy. Tim, go ahead and give us what's your current game. What are you playing right now?
I just finished, actually, a great game that I think, yeah, it kind of has like a completely different look on what strategy is. I think a lot of us, when we think about strategy games, we think of like a very gamey game of like, you know, how many points you have and how many resources of this you have, and you get a building and you make something and everything like that. You control some units, you move them around. And it's something that I've been itching for a really long time, and I finally found it, something different in Suzerain. To me, Suzerain, okay, it takes a totally different look on strategy where, it matches more with a role-playing game where you play as a president of a nation. And instead of like, you know, controlling some units and moving some things around and stuff, it plays it like an RPG. It's a mix of RPG and strategy game where you make like very strategic decisions by talking with people. Instead of, you know, like you move something or you click on something, you make an upgrade or whatever, you do none of that. You play by talking with people, which is like not something most of us are even used to doing, but basically you make decisions. Everyone that you talk to has their own agenda, has their own goals and so on. And you, as a president, basically you have to lead the nation in a direction that you feel like, you know, you can go in any different way. Again, it's like very RPG-like, but it's also extremely strategic in that it's about long-term planning. It's about resource allocation. It's about strategic decisions, not only with the nation, but also strategic decisions compared to other people. And that's something I've been itching to play for a long time, and I'm really happy that I finally found it. I thought I would have to make that game so I could play it before I could see it somewhere. And it's a real delight. It's very fresh, very novel, and very well done. The execution is really good, and it's very surprising, and you have like loads of possibilities and different directions you can go. Suzerain, really, I love playing it.
And choices matter. It sounds like it's that kind of game.
Like you have no idea. You will go through a full playthrough, and you will not even realize how much your choices have mattered. And then you play a second time, and like, oh my goodness, I made this other decision and I didn't realize how much it had impacted my play when I was doing it. But now that I made a different choice, everything turns out so differently. Like it's almost a brand new scenario, how much it has changed. And that's like very impressive that it has accomplished that.
So I'm going to go last here, and I'm going to go ahead and bring us full circle. The current game that I'm playing, it's not new. It's been around forever, but there's nothing like it. I am playing right now War in the Pacific, Admiral's Edition. So the original War in the Pacific is a Gary Grigsby game that came out in 2004. And if you know anything about turn-based strategy, Gary Grigsby is the godfather of all turn-based strategy games. He's got War in the East, War in the Pacific, War in the West, War Between the States, War This, War That. He is the guy from the 90s. In the early 2000s for turn-based strategy games. And I discovered this game on a whim maybe about 2 to 3 years ago watching some YouTube videos. A guy named Strategy Gaming Dojo, he had a YouTube channel, and he was showing tutorials, and he was playing a guy named Lodrick. And I really got into it because he was recording the turns and showing all the stuff going on, and I just got so excited about it. So basically, War in the Pacific is a gargantuan turn-based strategy game set in the Pacific, and the map boundary goes from Aden in the Middle East all the way over to the west coast of the United States. Now, what's cut out of there is Europe, because that would be a different game. But the scale of War in the Pacific is immense. From India, Australia, the South Pacific, the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, all of China, the Soviet Far East. It's all represented in this game. And to this day, we're still learning things about the game code and the game dynamics and the mechanics of this game that just aren't in the manual. The manual kind of sucks, and there's a reason for that, because they want there to be some mystery and some chance and some what ifs. They don't want people to game the mechanics so hard that you can just make it like you can't lose. There's always going to be a chance. Gary Grigsby, the guy that wrote the code for this, is world renowned for his using of dice, die rolls, to change, to add a little bit of chance into the combat calculations for this game. And that's why it's infinitely replayable. You can play against the AI, which I don't recommend, because it's a scripted AI and it's not very good. It's very early 2000s kind of AI. But where the game shines is when you do a play by email, which is basically a 1v1 with another human. And I've built a Discord server. I've built a YouTube channel on this game. You would be amazed at how many people are actually into this stuff. And it's infinitely replayable because you can do anything you want. When you start a new campaign, go ahead.
So how different is it from Hearts of Iron?
Oh, night and day. Hearts of Iron is fun. I would call that an arcade game. I know there's good some mods out there, like the Black Ice mods, that make it a little bit more engaging. But Hearts of Iron is more where you build an economy, you do a lot of political stuff, you do all that. War in the Pacific is nothing like that. There's no economy. Well, there is some economy to it, and there's a lot of logistics, but there's no political considerations. You don't build the same kind of things that you build like in Hearts of Iron. They're not comparable whatsoever.
Because I guess that's a fair warning to all those who try to pick up Hearts of Iron and find it like way too complex to ever even try, and find it like way too overwhelming. That's like a good warning to those people, right?
Well, if you think that Hearts of Iron is difficult and overwhelming, War in the Pacific is 10 times as complex.
That actually sounds very appealing.
Come check out my YouTube channel. I got tons of tutorials. What were you going to say?
Just how realistic is it?
Oh, it's depends. It depends on how realistic you want it to be. Now, for example, if you're playing a historical scenario, if you're playing, let's say, for Japan, all you're gonna get is what they got. Like, you can't decide to build, I want to build 10 new heavy cruisers, or I want to build 8 new carriers that they never had. You don't get that option. You get what they get, and your limit is to manage when they come out and how many resources you want to put into expediting the building of the ships they historically had. You can't just decide to build whatever the heck you want. It's predetermined. The scenario is created, so you're stuck with what you got. So if you're playing Japan in this game, you're on a time clock, because they only have so many battleships, so many carriers, so many cruisers, many this and that. And when you lose them, you don't get any more, because they didn't build any more during the war. Some people have done alternate scenarios and stuff where they add things in, but I don't play like that. I like to play with the historical stuff that they have, and it's
challenging. Is it two-player?
Yes. So the way I play is a play by email. So I'm actually currently in a campaign against another human player in the United States, and it's me versus him.
How does Japan win?
I play Japan because...
Yeah, but how do you win? What's the objective?
Say again?
How does Japan win? Like, what's the objective for Japan if they're on this time clock? Which I think is cool, this asymmetry in games, you know? But, like, what's their objective then?
So, briefly, because I don't want to monopolize the time on this thing. Sorry, but there's two ways you can win as Japan. So, there's a thing called auto-victory. And everything's built off of victory points, right? If you want to play this way, and it's not required, if by the end of 1942, if any player has a 4-to-1 victory point ratio over the other... the game is considered won. Now, not everybody plays that way. You don't have to stop playing if you get an auto victory on December 31st, 1942. You can say, heck, I'm going to keep playing. But if you do that as Japan, you're going downhill from there, because the amount of material and equipment and technology that the Allies develop as the war goes on, it becomes a mountain. And there's just no coming back from that. So the way I play... is I play for the auto victory. I want to be so good in the first year of the war that I cream the Allies and you just overwhelm them. And if I get to that point with this campaign where I get my auto victory, I'm calling it a win, and I'm not going to continue on. It's all downhill from there.
Shane, I'm curious to know, how long does a game of War in the Pacific takes.
Oh, years. So you can play different,
it takes longer turn than durations. The actual war, right?
Oh, way longer. So you can play 1-day turns, 2-day turns, 3-day turns, but the game shines on 1-day turns. But well, I'm playing against a human that has kids and work and life, so we don't always move one turn per day. So there's 1,700 turns, there's 1,700 days of World War II in the Pacific. It could take you 10 years to get to the end of this. I've never gone that far, but this game could take years to resolve. But it's a labor of love.
So it sounds like you would need like very evenly matched players to really enjoy
actually,
it. Otherwise,
you don't. What you want is the better player to play Japan because they carry the war. If you have a crappy Japanese player and they get steamrolled in the first month, the game is over. There's nowhere to go. You want your better player to always be Japan because they've got to carry the war, or the allies just overwhelm you. You know, if you have a bad start, you're done. So I would say that the better player should always play Japan in that game because it, you know,
it's really interesting. Actually, I really like the asymmetry.
Yeah. So the first year of the war, Japan is well positioned to do well because they were planning for it. They have the assets in place. The allies are scattered all over the place. They're in Europe dealing with Germany. They're not ready yet for the war. Japan was. So they're going to start off strong. And it takes a long time for the allies to build up steam and get ready. So you got about a year to really flex as Japan before the numerical superiority of the allies just take you out. So that's how I play. I like to think I'm a strong Japanese player, and I like to play and go hard, really hard for that first year and overwhelm the allies and take my win if I can get it. That's the way I play the game, but you don't have to play that way. Okay, anyway, I'm going to wrap this up today. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you'll tune in next week where we're going to be discussing the best strategy games of 2024. And does anybody have any plugs as we head out the door?
I do. Go and check strategygaming.com. We just reached 1 million views. Go.
Awesome. Well, Tim, you got anything? Got a plug?
No, I'm good.
No, you just called that strategygaming.com. That's the wrong...
No, strategyandwargaming.com.
Strategyandwargaming.com for Nuno. And then, of course, I have a YouTube channel. We've got about 8,500 subs. It's called Jochenheiden's Combined Fleet. I do mostly War in the Pacific content. A little bit of flight simming on the side. It's just a side hobby of mine, but... If you're interested in this game that I just talked about, come check it out. I got you covered.
Thanks, guys. I'll see you next week.
See you next week, guys.
See you next week. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.